originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Pena and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, along with the Pontiff of the Pick Four, Pope Jude, Jude Feld, and we welcome everyone tuning in throughout North America on Sirius 219 XM, Channel 206, and everyone joining us worldwide on your computer or your mobile device at horseracingradio.net. Happy to have you with us for another edition of Trainer Talk, and JT, as has become customary on this program, it's not just about the Todd Pletchers of the world and the Bob Bafferts of the world. We often focus on trainers who have interesting stories, but maybe people aren't as familiar with those stories because they're not out there in the public eye as much, and that's what we have here tonight.
Yeah, it's very exciting. I love to have the young guys on, the new trainers, and be able to find out who they are and what makes them want to do this for a living. It's always entertaining.
You've been there. You know what that's all about. And you know, you think about guys like Pletcher and Baffert and Mott. I mean, they had to start somewhere too. When they've come on this program, they've talked about those early days. And Bill Mott talking about not being able to get stalls at Centennial Park at one point because his horses weren't good enough. Who would ever think of a guy like Bill Mott being in that position?
Yeah, well, it happens. We were talking about that before we went on the air about how it used to be, you know, stalls were at a premium. Nowadays, if you have a mane and a tail, they'll give you a stall because everybody's fighting for horses. And we talked about that over the weekend with Santa Anita's Mike Willman about the need for more horses in California. Big horse shortage there. But in the old days, races overfilled all the time. You needed 4 or 5 stars to get in a main race and all of that. But it's a little different game now.
Well, our guest tonight for the next hour here on Trainer Talk is a gentleman who was raised right here in Lexington, Kentucky, which is exactly where this show is originating from in our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios here for you. He was raised on a breeding farm. He became interested in eventing at a very young age before finally transitioning over to thoroughbreds when he was in high school. Took out his trainer's license in 2010. Now, he's only saddled 40 horses on his own, most of those coming in the past year and a half or so, but he's already found the winner's circle on 3 different occasions, and he is trainer Sam Logsdon, who joins us now here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Sam, welcome, my friend, and thanks for coming in the studio.
Well, thanks, guys. It's an honor to be here.
Yeah, happy to have you on board and looking forward to hearing your story. You know, you hear me mention those names of some of the more prominent trainers in the sport, but like I told Jude, I mean, they all start somewhere, right?
Got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Where did everything start for you? I mentioned the breeding farm.
Well, yeah.
You raised here in Lexington.
Grew up here in Lexington on a breeding, racing, and research farm. My dad was a farm manager. You know, my whole family goes pretty far back. My uncle trained. My dad worked for him. He, and kind of where the horses originated in our family, is he in the 50s took a job riding with a vet in Shelbyville, Kentucky. That's where my family is originally from. And he just kind of got bit and just loved it and just wanted more and more. So he ended up going down to Laredo, Texas in the 60s and ran a ranch for a guy, John Meekum. Had 2 ranches down there, was kind of just a foreman, but one of his ranches was on an old World War II blimp site, and the guy had turned it into a training center for his racehorses. So that's when Uncle Dave really got bit with racing. You know, he had developed a keen sense for horses and knew that's what he wanted to do, but when he got around racehorses, he knew that was the future. So he went to work for this guy and you know, learned a little bit about training and ended up bringing a string back to Lexington. And that's when my dad started working for him. My dad started walking hots for him and ended up going down to fairgrounds with him to rub some horses. And then my dad went to work for a guy named Homer Pardue. My uncle got down there and all his horses got claimed pretty quick. Uncle packed up and came home, and then my dad was bit. My dad wanted to stay on the track. So he went to work for a guy named Homer Pardue, and spent several years doing that. And then dad actually walked away from horses to start a family, and they got married and moved back to Shelbyville, and probably 10 years didn't mess with horses. And then he got offered the farm manager job of the farm where I grew up. So he went there, and that guy at some point decided he wanted to buy some racehorses too. That when I was a kid, all we had was yearlings and broodmares and that sort of thing. Oh, the guy bought some racehorses, and dad says, well, I kind of know how to train them. So, so he set dad up with a string, and I was a teenager then. And I'd been eventing horses. I was, from the time I could walk, they couldn't keep me off their back. So they figured they better go get me some instruction. So they sent me for some lessons, and I got in that was about 8 years old. And when dad started training, I was a teenager, and I started helping him break yearlings and stuff. And, kind of just went from there. Yeah, I think they thought, put him in the barn, it'll scare him into going to college. And it had the opposite effect. Yeah, here we are 15 years later.
We hear that sometimes. Yeah. Trainers, their parents have different plans for them. And then the other trainers, their family's really supportive of it, even though they may think they're crazy. They go, well, whatever you want to do. Yeah. That's pretty cool. Eventing and breaking babies is like two different things. It's like going from the antique old horses to something new that's going to buck you off all the time. How was that?
Yeah, I mean, it was good. I was young and dumb enough to like it. I was 15, and the thought of breaking a horse just seemed so cool to me. So dad couldn't keep me off the back of him.
How about the first time you ever tried it? Was it still cool?
You know what? Yeah. I mean, I think
I've heard some horror stories.
The first time I galloped a horse on the racetrack, dad said it looked like I was riding for the Derby when I came in. I was just having a blast, he actually, we broke some babies on the farm, and he was okay with me doing that. I had a good seat, and I didn't really know what I was doing, but I could stay on top of one, and then we got to the, we moved the horses from the farm to the track after they got broke. And he told me, like, we're going to hire an exercise rider. You're going to groom, you're going to rub some horses for me. And it got to the point where I was okay with that, but I was just itching to ride. So I was beating dad to the barn in the morning and freelancing, and then he caught me. So he said, well, if you're going to ride, you're going to ride for me, I guess. So at about 16, I started galloping on the track for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is there anything that you took from the eventing world and what you learned there that kind of helped you when you went over to thoroughbreds?
I think just having a deep seat as far as being a rider.
For people that don't understand what that means, what's that mean?
Yeah, you just, it's kind of hard to explain without saying just sit deep, long irons, staying on their backs,
don't fall off.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you're kind
your
of
job between your legs.
Our listeners can't see, but you're kind of a tall guy, obviously thin. The fact that horses appreciate that.
Yeah.
That's why they don't like me. They always give me the side eye when I show. that there's an old racetrack expression, the longer you ride, the longer you ride.
That's right.
And that's because when you do have your stirrup set low, and it gives you a little bit more leverage and control. And
exactly.
I think that's one of the reasons you'll see Mikey Smith kick his legs out of the irons and sit there on top of the horse to relax them a little bit and make them feel like they're not going to the gate or going to work or just kind of kick back.
Yeah, I would say so. Talking with Sam Logsdon, a trainer who, as you can hear, started off in some different career paths and then found his way to the training side of things. Okay, let me ask you this question.
Yep.
Training is not easy, right?
Nope. And
Jude had a piece. We talk about it all the time. He wrote a piece that won an Eclipse Award where if it was easy, everyone would do it.
Everyone
was the
would
name
do
of
it.
The piece.
Yep.
Why would anyone want to be a horse trainer?
Oh, you have to love it. I mean, I think that's what it boils down to. I don't think anybody that doesn't absolutely love it would last a day. There's obviously been times, I think probably a lot of trainers have sat here and told you that there's been times where you question it and you wonder, is this really what I want to do? But I think even in those moments, I've always known back in my mind, this is it, I like to think it's a good thing to be that confident in your future and know that this is, regardless of the ups and downs, this is what you want to do. So I think a lot of people probably don't have that in their careers. that they probably spend a lot more time wondering about if they're doing what is right than I do, because I've known for a long time.
Talk about some of the struggles that somebody like yourself, who's just kind of getting his operation off the ground, goes through when they're getting started in this game.
Obviously, a lot goes into the infrastructure of a barn, and I know when I started, I had a lot of, you know, a lot of green, purple, blue webbings, polos, bridles, whatever it is. I had so many family members that all trained and all their colors were different. Everything just got passed on to me, and that helped. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a big part of it is you got to have some finance to get started. You have to. Those first couple months are going to be tough. I was really fortunate this time. You mentioned earlier that I pulled my trainer's license in 2010. Only ran a couple of horses, and I could tell it wasn't going to go well. I didn't have the right people behind me or the right horses in my barn, and I just kind of shut it down. And I just kind of told myself, I want to do this, but I want to do it right, and I want to make sure the time is right. And I was really fortunate when I left my previous job to find Gunpowder Farm, and they've been a huge supporter. They're probably 80% of my horses, and I think a lot of people work their whole lives for a client like that, and they've been incredibly supportive. It could have been a lot harder than it has been because they were there with me. So really, really supportive from day one.
Well, it's always nice to have that client that's etched in stone, and you don't have to worry, and you know you're going to continue to have horses coming your way, because training horses is hard enough without having to go out and hustle.
Exactly.
That type of thing. So,
it helps other clients take you a little more seriously when you have 20 in the barn already. You know, it's easier to pick up those next five than as opposed to when you have five trying to pick up five.
It's the first question that people ask you when thinking about hiring you as a trainer. How many horses do you have? Mm-hmm. And that's like the worst question ever, because do you want me to have a whole bunch?
Yeah.
So it looks like other people are saps, not just you, mm-hmm. or do you want me to have a few because you want that hands-on care? Right. Yep. And there's never the right answer, you know? So if you tell somebody, well, I've got 12, you know, well, that may not go over too well. Mm-hmm. If you tell somebody you've got 40, they go, well, I'm just going to be another number.
Right.
You know, so.
Well, I think they see the success of guys like Todd Pletcher and Steve Aspison and Bob Baffert, who have horses all over the country and have tons and tons of horses. And they see that success, and they see them on the big stage and in the spotlight all the time, and say, that's what I want. That's the dream. Right. And they feel like they can only get there if they have somebody like that in their corner. But that's not the case, though, is it, Sam?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I think it helps people take you seriously. You know what I mean? It's really hard to express to somebody that you can do a good job with 40 horses. I've never done it, but I can't. You know what I mean? It's really hard to tell somebody that I know I can do this. Give me the chance. Like I said, I was really fortunate at the Gunpowder.
How did that relationship come about?
Well, actually, so when I got back to the States, we didn't talk about this earlier, but I went to New Zealand for about 6 months just to kind of, after the pulled my trainer's license in 2010 and I could see it wasn't going well, I went to New Zealand for about 6 months and worked for a breaking and pre-training operation down there. Just kind of, you know, I knew if I wanted to start over, I wanted to do something new. I didn't want to just go back to galloping horses. I wanted to do something to, you know, improve the resume. So I went down there and worked for 6 months. And when I came back, Margo Farm here in Midway was kind of amping up their training operation, and they needed an assistant. And I thought, well, if I'm not going to go right back to training, this is a good spot. So I went out there, and actually at the time Gunpowder had horses there. So I met them and built a relationship with them there. And, even after they had parted ways with Margo, and we always stayed in contact and stayed good friends with them and their racing manager, Josh Stevens. And, you know, they always kind of said, you know, if you ever decide to go out on your own, or, you know, just let us know, we'll help you out. And, you know, you get told that a lot when you're coming up, especially when you're assistants for other barns and stuff. People always say, well, you ever go out on your own? You never know. You never know if that's just an empty gesture or if people will actually go to bat for you. And I called them and said, you know, I've decided it's time. I've got two horses and I'm going out. And sure enough, they acted on it pretty quick and filled me up. And, you know, we're just incredibly helpful getting me started. And they've been good to me. Absolutely.
Yeah, you think about names like Divisadero and Breaking Lucky when you think about you know, Gunpowder Farms. They've been involved with some really, really nice horses. Yep.
Who is Gunpowder Farms? is that okay to say?
Tom Keithley and Erica Davini. They're a couple in Pennsylvania. They've got horses at Fair Hill as well. They're just a couple, Gunpowder Farms. They just really enjoy the game, and they're serious about it. They're business people, and they're, this is very fun for them, but they're serious about it, and they want people that are going to do a good job, and they want, you know, all of us to work together as a team. And I think we finally here in the last couple of years kind of gotten the rhythm, and we've kind of put together a good program. And I couldn't be training for better people.
What's the program like?
So essentially all of them come to me as yearlings and get broke. And then I keep all their layups too. So anytime something happens with another trainer and they got to send them back to the farm for a break, they come back to me. I kind of reassess them, make sure everything's a go, put 30, 60, 90 days in them, depending on the horse, and then send them back. So that's kind of where I fit in. And last year they sent me one horse to play with that they just weren't having a whole lot of luck with. Hadn't gotten her to the races yet. So it was like the first one they sent me to run. And we won a race at Keeneland with her this year, so that was awesome. And I've expressed some interest with them in the last couple months about maybe running some more, and they've been incredibly supportive. So I think my role is kind of changing a little bit, and I'm going to be running some more for them.
Was that Poor Girl?
That was Poor Girl. Yep. She was fun. That was the first horse they sent me to run, and it took us a while to get the light bulb to go on, but I really liked her from day one. She was a gutsy little filly, and she was always a good workhorse. I knew something was there, and we just weren't finding it.
How frustrating is that?
Incredibly. But you know, I kind of got her at a bad time too, because I got her in December of her 2-year-old year. She's really immature, really small. She was a really bad stall walker, and she was probably 50, 60 pounds underweight just from running around the stall all day, you know? So I got her in the winter, and she kind of gave me the impression pretty quick that she was a turf horse and didn't really care for Turfway. Never performed like I thought she would at Turfway. And then probably the worst thing I did with her is I ran her at Keeneland in the spring on the dirt, and she ran second. And I was like, okay, well, maybe she can run on the dirt a little bit. I ran her two more times in the dirt, and I kind of abandoned my hopes of grass with her. And she didn't really fire the next two times. So when we made the switch to turf, the light bulb went off. And it was just, you know, like I said, bad time of year for me to get her and be convinced that she was a turf horse, because I didn't really have any options. You know, being a Central Kentucky trainer in December.
Is there anything worse?
There's not a lot.
The frozen tundra. Yeah,
there's not a lot. I've spent my last winter in Kentucky, I'll tell you that much.
What will you do next if you don't stay here in Kentucky in the winter?
This winter I plan on going to Tampa.
Yeah.
Taking a small stranger to Tampa and leaving the breaking and pre-training operation here. Taking 5 or 6 down there and you know. At this point this year,
More for you or the horses?
Well,
to go to the warm weather.
It's kind of a little of both. I put myself out of some clients here late this year that were going to send me some turf horses that I just kind of said, well, look, it's probably not the greatest idea to send me turf horses right now. So I thought, you know, if I'm going to move forward with this, I need to be able to extend the turf season. So I'll be going to Tampa 5 or 6 head, I hope.
Yeah. Turf racing's become very popular, finally. Mm-hmm. And now Fasig Tipton's going to have that special turf sale too, which is kind of cool. There's a little plug for our sponsor.
In September. Here in Lexington, by the way.
I love it, and Gunpowder breeds a ton for turf. So, and that's the kind of horse I like training anyway.
Yeah.
So it's fun.
Is there a difference between training a turf horse and a dirt horse?
I think so. What do you think? Yeah,
definitely.
I think so. I think definitely.
I love turf horses too. I mean, it's just, I have an affinity for them. I like gambling on them too. I much prefer turf racing. It's just,
yeah.
So what do you do differently with a turf horse than a dirt horse?
I would think that dirt horses probably hold up a little better you can do a little more with them. I don't think you have to do as much with turf horses. Would you agree?
I think so. And it's the way that turf races are run. Turf racing, you know, is about pace, and usually it's slow early, fast late. Mm-hmm. So you're always wanting your horses to finish in the morning when you're working, and if you're running on the dirt all the time, horses need to have a little bit more speed. Mm-hmm. And so you'll be a little sharper with them, make them show speed. Some trainers are excellent at turning horses into speed horses. I mean, let's start at the top, Bob Baffert, but a guy that I came up under that I worked for, Julio Canani, he was one of the greatest guys to take a horse that was kind of a slug and put some speed into him. And it's a knack. It's about jogging. It's a feel thing. It's like, learning the horse's idiosyncrasies and then trying to set them up so that they show more speed. And in turf racing, it's almost the exact opposite. Turf horses that go wire to wire to me are exceptional. Most turf races are not won on the lead. Mm-hmm. So in turf racing, you want to be able to finish and you want to be able to save ground in the race. Those are the two keys to turf racing, in my opinion. So yep. You don't want the horses to have that zing out of the gate as a rule. Now, there's always exceptions. Mm-hmm. You know, a horse like Little Mike that used to go wire to wire. I mean, the horse was a freak.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, he won the Breeders' Cup. So that those horses accepted your day in, day out turf races is about finishing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sam Logsdon with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Sam, you talked earlier about going to New Zealand and spending some time there after you'd taken out your trainer's license. Tell me about that experience. What was that like?
It was fun. I stepped a little bit out of my comfort zone. For sure, they do things a little differently down there. And the place I did mostly breaking and pre-training, which kind of fit into what I was trying to develop here. And they did a lot of the what they call the ready-to-run sales, which is kind of like our two-year-old in training sales.
What do they do differently there?
Well, for the two-year-old in training aspect of it, those horses breeze a little slower and a little further. They call them the ready-to-run sales because they're just about ready to run. But what I noticed kind of off the bat was, you break horses here for people, and everybody does things slightly different, but there's at least a common theme when you go from one farm to the next breaking their horses, and it's kind of all similar. It was very different there. The first few days was bareback. We did a lot of driving from the ground, which I hadn't done before, but I found interesting. And then the bareback was interesting too. I spent 6 months there. I still didn't really get it, but I did it, I was happy to try it. Like I said, it was just kind of, I think it made me grow as a horseman because it made me step out of my comfort zone. I'd been galloping horses for over a dozen years at that point and had to go and learn a different way to do it. And they want their horses a little more forward and on the bit than we do here. I would say on average, a stronger gallop down there than what we're used to here. So they want, we got two-year-olds in, they wanted them galloping on and on the muscle, and they wanted their exercise rider staff to work for it. So, I think it was, once you learn to sit a horse, you learn to sit a horse, but just stepping out of my comfort zone a little and doing something that I had done for so long totally differently was fun. I didn't bring a whole lot of the practices home. I'm not breaking yearlings bareback up the road. but I think it made me grow, it made me say, okay, well, I survived 6 months down there. American racing is going to be easy, I can survive that. I'll stay on any American horse.
It's funny. You get a different perspective when you go to a different country and see things or talk to people that train horses in different countries. I had a horse one time that was not running well. His name was Janitor. And come to find out, he really didn't like the saddle, the irons more than the saddle. He was from Brazil.
Yeah.
And I guess they do a lot of bareback.
A lot of barebacking there.
Yep. And one day I took him out without the irons on the saddle. We put the saddle on because we knew the outriders were gonna balk anyway, but I was always pressing the outriders. I did some wild things because when you're training horses that maybe aren't that good, you have to be creative. So I take him out there. Well, actually I didn't take him, but my exercise girl Amy took him to the track without the irons on the saddle, and he galloped so great, and the outriders picked her up and chewed her out, and then he came to me and, what are you doing? I said, well, this horse hasn't been going good, and I wanted to try something different, and it just kind of occurred to me that maybe this would be the thing. And they go, well, you can't bring the horse out without irons. And I said, come on, guys, let me gallop him. I'll gallop him like quarter of 10 every day when the track is pretty much all but closed.
You'll gallop him.
Amy will gallop him.
I just wanted to clarify before we get PETA like weighing in.
So
on
they
the
let
show.
Me. They let me do it. They let me do it for a while, and he really turned around, and he ended up winning. I don't know, like three races at Santa Anita. You know, it just changed his life. He was happy finally, and that's all it took to make him happy. So
I would have had to say, show me in the rule book where it says I have to use irons.
Yeah, they paid no attention to the rule book in California. Believe me, the rule book meant nothing. It was their word, or that's it. It's like, so
what would be the point of breaking baby's bareback? Why would they do that?
Like I said, 6 months in, and I never
figured it out.
Well, I think it was more or less introduce one thing at a time, where we do the same thing. We just introduce the saddle before we introduce the person. So I think that was the theory, and I'm sure they would do a better job at explaining why they did it. But honestly, I wasn't there to tell them how to do what they were doing. Right. I was there to do what they told me to do. So when he said jump on that horse, I jumped on that horse, you know. it was fun.
Did you ever think about being a jockey?
When I was probably 11 or 12, but I was 6 foot tall in high school. So that was nixed pretty quick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Not even a steeplechase jockey.
No. I remember when I was probably, I just started eventing horses. I was, 95, Thunder Gulch won the Derby. And I watched it at my grandparents' house and thought, I remember that day thinking, like, that's what I want to do. It's like 8 years old. That's what I want to be a jockey. And like I said, that lasted a few years before I realized I was going to be a little big for that. But
that was Gary Stevens, right?
Yeah.
Thunder Gulch.
Mm-hmm.
D. Wayne Lucas.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you ever get a chance to, have you met Gary?
I have not. No. It'd be an interesting story.
You can tell him that story.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, man.
Tell him he's your inspiration. So if Thunder Gulch had never happened, then maybe we wouldn't be sitting here talking to Sam saying, hey, this is, I kind of doubt that though. Who knows? Sounds like you were bit right from the young age.
Yeah. I knew horses were my thing. I think that day for some reason I was just like, man, I want to be a jockey.
It also seems to me that the horses find you and your family.
Yeah.
Which isn't always the case with the trainers that we have on, but it seems like the horses would show up one of you guys would be there to go, wow, this is cool.
Yeah. Essentially, it's exactly how it kept happening. You know, like I said, my dad walked away for 10 years and just kind of got offered this job out of the blue. Said, well, yeah, I kind of know about horses. And little did he know what he was starting, you know, by moving the family there.
Well, it's a fun story, and we're going to hear more of Sam Logsdon's journey when we come back in the second half of the show. We'll talk about horses like Divisadero and Breaking Lucky, who he's been around through the relationship with Gunpowder Farms. We're going to do that next. Stay with us. This is Trainer Talk, and it's all presented by Fasig Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Nominate your yearlings now to the Fasig Tipton Summer Selected Yearling Sales. These sales are the top three yearling sales in North America by rate of return. The July sale in Lexington, Kentucky, July 10th and 11th. The Saratoga sale in Saratoga Springs, New York, August 7th and 8th. And the New York Bred sale in Saratoga Springs, New York, August 12th and 13th. Selected sales, superior results. Nominate today at FasigTipton.com.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pin hooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
Kentucky Downs kicks off a unique five-day all-grass race meet in September. Live racing September 3rd, 8th, 10th, 11th, and 15th. And the stakes are high with $7.8 million in purses over the 5 days, an average of $1.56 million each day. Kentucky Breds will run for maiden special weight purses of $130,000 and allowance purses of $145,000. Maidens not bred in Kentucky will compete for $58,000 with top allowance for non-Kentucky Breds at $67,000. Learn more at KentuckyDowns.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. to race the best.
Super Saver Ross Amaya, what a finish to the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
Now is the perfect time to own a Kentucky bred and race in Kentucky. Kentucky breds win 70% of the greatest stakes in North America, and it's obvious that Kentucky breds start with a clear advantage. But there's more. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start. Learn more at KentuckyBred.org.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Top of the stretch now. Beach Patrol trying to see it out. Turns for home in front. Half a length advantage. Enterprising trying to get by in second. Oscar Nominate is coming hard. And here comes Divisadero flying down the crown of the course. Beach Patrol trying to dig down. Divisadero rallying from behind. But Beach Patrol has something left for the final 16th. Divisadero surges up alongside and surges to win it. Divisadero runs down Beach Patrol. Oscar Performance was third and Casaqui was fourth.
Travis Stone with the call to visit Darrow, winning the Woodford Reserve Turf Classic at Churchill Downs. That was the race right before the Kentucky Derby, and boy, was it a special one for Divisadero. He won it for the second year in a row for owners Gunpowder Farms, trainer Buff Bradley, and jockey Julian Leperoux. We are talking with Sam Logsdon here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Want to welcome everybody back to the program. Everybody tuning in on Sirius 219, XM 206, and worldwide on our website, horseracingradio.net. Don't forget, if you did miss any portion of this show, you can head over to our website and you can check out the podcast of this show and all of our shows. They're all there for you, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Well, Sam, I can imagine, considering the relationship you have with Gunpowder Farms, and you talked earlier about being around Divisadero. That had to be a very special moment for you to see him win that race for a second consecutive year.
Yeah, that was fun. I was present both years, and it was, you know, what a blast. I mean, just to be associated with an operation like this. And also Buff has been incredibly helpful. And actually, when I was thinking about going out on my own before I even had Gunpowder in my corner, Buff was in my corner kind of pushing me and telling me, you know, this, if you think the time is right, then do it, and was really supportive. And so just to be there for Divisadero and to be there for Buff, that was amazing. And
Buff's a great guy.
He's an awesome guy. He's incredibly supportive and just, you know, shirt off your back kind of guy.
And one of the best trainers I think we have in Kentucky. A freak.
Yeah.
I don't think he gets the respect that he deserves. He's at the horses that he's had. I mean, going all the way back to like Brass Hat, right? I mean, he has just been around some unbelievable horses and done a masterful job of bringing them along in their careers
and lengthening their careers. I think he does an incredible job at getting the most of a horse, but also knowing when pump the brakes, give him some time. I mean, I think he's done a masterful job with the Visadero, and the couple times where he's needed a little break, Buff's backed off. And that's another thing I think you have to give Gunpowder some credit for as well, is they are incredible about that. If you call them and say, "Hey, I need some time on this one," they, you know, ship him. You know, and I think between Buff having that stance and Gunpowder being open into that, they found a rhythm with this horse that, you know, they're going to do well with him. And I think he's got some races left in him. So it's been awesome to be a part of that horse.
Yeah, we got to give you some credit for this too, because you're the guy that rehabbed him and brought him back.
Yeah, but, you know, Buff always quit on him before anything really happened. Yeah. You know, Buff always sent him home sound and just said he needs some time. So my job was always easy when he came back in. Get him going again, get him halfway fit again. And Buff, considering that's been his big horse the last couple of years, has been incredibly hands-off when he's in my barn. You know what to do. Call me when he's ready. And that's been awesome that somebody like that has entrusted such a good horse with me.
I was going to ask you that question. How, I mean, it doesn't sound like you were in constant communication necessarily, right? Because he was letting you do your thing when you had Divisadero.
Yeah,
but how closely do you work together when Divisadero isn't at the racetrack?
I mean, I think it, you know, at least weekly phone calls, something along that line. You know, sometimes, I mean, I probably call Buff more than that, but it's rarely for anything important. It's usually a dumb question. But he always answers, and he never, you know, never once has questioned anything that I'm doing, or you know, he's had total faith in me every time they've sent me one of his horses. So, that's been awesome. You know,
what's the best advice that Buff's ever given you?
Oh, I'm not sure I can repeat it on air. I'm just kidding, but seriously, something did come to mind. No, I think if anything, he's taught me patience. It may not be a quote that I can give you, but I think, you know, watching him and how he operates and how he runs the stable and how he campaigns these older horses has proven to me that patience pays off tenfold. You know, when you've got the right horse and, you know, you need to make that call, you make that call. And, without having to tell me that, he taught me that, you know?
Yeah.
I think sometimes too, that's lost on a lot of people when they're selecting a trainer. You know, they're looking at the percentages, they're looking at the amount of wins and all that. Yeah. But when you see horses, and this is something that always attracts me to a trainer, and one of the reasons that I like Buff so much is when horses have careers, it makes a world of difference.
Yeah.
Especially to a smaller owner,
yeah,
to one that doesn't have the resources to go out and buy 20 horses every year. Yeah. You know, for somebody to invest in a nice horse and then have that horse be able to run when they're 5-6 years old is magnificent.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's something that you don't see in the standings, something that you don't,
yeah,
you don't think about, yeah, day in, yeah, and day out, unless you've been involved in the business or you know how it goes.
There's no way to quantify that. There's no way to put that on Equibase, you know, that, the amount of years you can get out of a horse. There's no way to give anybody the credit for that they deserve. You're right.
Everybody has a mentor or somebody that has encouraged them along the way. Buff Bradley, obviously an integral part of where you are today, Sam. Who else has helped you along the way?
Well, obviously, you know, just hearing stories of my uncle. My uncle, you know, kind of predates me so far that by the time I was, you know, he's still with us, but by the time I was of age to really be interested in it, he was done training. But I grew up on stories of him. So I think without knowing it, he was also very integral in it. And my father and just his love for the animal. You know, I think that was a big part of it. And then cousins, Robbie Logston, who now works for a farrier supply company, and Robin Parks, who galloped on the track and, you know, was one of the best hands on a horse I've ever seen. He helped me a lot when I was, you know, trying to become an exercise rider. And, you know, obviously just about every guy I've ever swung a leg over for, you know, is I've tried to take something good and something bad away from their barns and, you know, found the things that I wanted to learn from them and the things that I thought, well, that's not how I want to do it. You know? So I think when you want to be a trainer, every job you ever work, you have to let that be an integral part of what your future is, whether you agree with what you're doing or you're not, you're going to learn one way or the other, you know? So I think just, you know, you have to be open to everywhere you go and try to learn something all the time. Mostly the family members, dad and uncle and cousins, all just kind of push me, and none of them are training now. So it's been fun for them. We all went to I ran Poor Girl at Churchill last week, and it was actually Uncle Dave's first time he'd ever been to one of my races. So that was cool. So they're really into it now because I'm training now.
Is that where she ran second?
She ran second. Well, we finished third, got moved up.
That's always nice.
Yeah. You know, it was kind of I really needed to win that one, but it's okay. You know, I beat myself up every time we lose. So,
yeah, we talked about percentages earlier, and you've only started 4 horses this year. You've already had the one winner, so you're batting 25%. That's pretty good, my friend.
I guess not. Yeah, I guess it's not too bad.
Look on the bright side.
Yeah, but
you have to. When you're a horse trainer every morning, when you're just looking for a little ray of sunshine, that's all.
Yeah.
I used to tell my dad, I wish I could just win one race a month. If I could just win one race a month, I'd be awesome. Happy. Yeah. Right? Because no bad streaks, no long losing streaks, no 0-46. Thank you, Santa Anita. It's just one race a month would be happy.
I think that's something that people tell you and you don't really appreciate it until you start training, is that there is a pendulum swing to this. And I don't know what causes it, but they tell you this and you have to experience it. It really is. There's periods of nothing but lows and there's periods of nothing but highs. And I think you have to be willing to let it swing, you know? So I try not to get too down when we get beat, but I'm a bad loser. So
why'd you feel like you needed to win that race so bad?
You know, she's just come back in such great form this year. And I really thought she'd appreciate the mile and eighth. I think the soft turf is really what did us in that day. I know they had it listed as firm, but I didn't think that it was. And you know, she'd won the one other than at Keeneland against some really tough horses that have all come back and run some impressive races since then. So I figured a starter 16 she was going to be salty there, you know, and, we hooked that horse Sugar Cube, who's just a monster. So I knew we were gonna have to run to beat that one. But honestly, I thought going into it that race was kind of ours for the taking. I kind of looked at it as a confidence booster because I ran her on Oaks Day and they took it off the turf, and she didn't like the slop. And we decided to give her a shot, but she didn't care for it. So I thought I owed it to her. The point of that race was I thought I owed her an easier spot. And it came up pretty salty, so sorry, girl.
talk about that. You said something interesting, and I think that's a one thing that a lot of people don't realize about trainers. You said you felt like you owed it to her. I think sometimes when you're training horses and you're close to them, when you don't have a huge stable, yeah. you're a little bit more cognizant of that, and you want the horses to do well for them.
Yeah.
Not necessarily for you. Yeah. You're not really, I don't know. People used to ask me, well, my first wife used to ask me if I won a race. Oh, how much was the purse?
Yeah.
I don't know. I would run for a ham sandwich. Yeah,
exactly.
I don't care.
Exactly.
I won a race today, you know? So that was just, it's a difference in personalities, but for the horse, talk about that.
Well, you know, this filly is a filly that, you know, if you look back at her form, every time she's been on the turf, she's just run her eyeballs out. Every single time against horses that she shouldn't beat. I mean, every race she's won, she's beat horses she's on paper that she shouldn't beat. And it's because she's just got all the heart in the world, you know? So when you get a filly like that, I think especially a filly, you don't want to throw too many ringers at them where they're going to get beat. You know, she tries like that every time you owe her a win occasionally, you know? So I felt like after she went out and ran on the slop, despite not really caring for it and didn't run a terrible race, I felt like I owed her one. Cause we've got some big plans for her this summer and we're going to try some things. So I thought, well, let's go into the summer on a win and I'll find a spot for her. And I found that. And I thought, well, this is going to be ours, you know? So that was frustrating, but she ran a good race and just bad racing luck that day, I think, you know.
You mentioned you're somewhat of a bad loser. You don't like to lose.
Yeah, I don't.
Right?
Like
you're very competitive. Does that go back to your wrestling days at Woodford County High School?
Yeah, I think so. We were none of my brothers. We were not good losers.
Must have made the Monopoly games a little difficult.
I'm not sure Monopoly survived in our house.
The pickup basketball games.
Yeah,
were.
Exactly. Yeah, they turned into pickup boxing matches. Three brothers.
Yeah, you said you were 6 foot tall in high school. Why wrestling instead of maybe basketball?
You know, everybody asks that, but I think you also have an advantage as a wrestler when you're tall and lanky. You got some leverage on the shorter guys, because if you think about it, you know, they have to weigh the same as me. So if they're shorter than me, they've got to be rounder than me. So at least in high school, you know, I think I would have struggled in college. Because those guys are, you know, they're no joke. But I think it, you know, in high school, it worked as an advantage. But I get asked that a lot because it is the same season as basketball. Like, why would you spend your basketball season, you know, being 6 foot tall in high school wrestling? We loved it. That was my family. You know, if it wasn't horses, it was wrestling. That was all we did.
Is that still your favorite sport outside of horse racing?
Yeah. I don't follow a ton of sports outside of horse racing, but I do follow wrestling. Yeah. Absolutely. My cousin's still a coach at Woodford County High School in Versailles, Rusty Parks. So we follow even from the high school level.
Yeah.
Still follow it. So, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people might be surprised by that, especially being here in Kentucky. You see a guy 6 foot in high school and he doesn't play basketball,
mm-hmm.
but,
yep.
you know, obviously wrestling the way to go for Sam Logsdon, who is our guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fayza Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Tell me about your very first winner that you had on your own.
Poor girl.
She means a lot to you.
Yeah, she does. She does. Yeah. That's the filly. And she's taught me a lot because she's quirky. She actually, I'd run her the first time I ran her on the grass. I had James Graham on her at Ellis last year, and she's quirky. I mean, she's one I got a saddle on the walk, and she's been known to do some things in the post parade. And she actually goes off without a pony now. We figured that out. That pony can be near her, but don't touch her. So anyway, we took her to Ellis and I put James Graham on her, and she flipped in the post parade, walking onto the grass. It's first time on the grass. It got loose, and it's just like the worst feeling in the world. She got loose right in front of us at the grandstand at Ellis, and then breezed all the way to the backside. And I'm going, well, we're scratched. You know, I finally get to try this filly on the turf, and we're scratched. And no, James Graham got up and said, no, bring her back. We're going in. And she tried to win it. We got in some trouble. Actually, that day we finished third and got moved up to second as well. She's got a knack for finding trouble. So I ran her back pretty quick. I ran her back at Ellis, and she actually tried to do the same thing. She reared up, and Declan Cannon slid off of her in the post parade. And but then she went out and won for fun. So that was good. But she's been fun to have in the barn, because, like I said, once she hit the turf, she just never stops trying. She's one that you can rely on, that you put her in the right spot. It's all up to me with her. You know, you got to go to the right spot, because she's going to run against anything, you know.
How do you handle those moments when your horses are walking in to the starting gate? Are you nervous? A few butterflies?
I've gotten better, because at the end of the day, it's out of your hands. But yeah, I was a nervous wreck the first few starts. Even though, you know, I was kind of ship and run guy for Dad for so long that I'd done it a thousand times. But, you know, it's different when they're yours, I've gotten better, but I was very nervous for a while. I blame a lot of that on poor girl. She makes you nervous.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I can imagine.
If you don't know if she's going to flip when she steps in the grass. Those fillies sometimes, they can really be a nightmare.
She's a push button horse to train. There's nothing wrong in the morning. Afternoon, she knows what's going on. She gets a little keyed up. So, but we figured out our quirks, and I've got the right rider on her now, and I've got race day protocol down, what she needs to do to get to the winner's circle. So I think we're in for a good year with her. She's going to be fun.
So looking ahead, what are some of the goals that you've laid out for you, for your operation? Where do you see yourself moving forward?
As much as I love developing young horses, I think that's something I always want to do. I would always like to keep a breaking and pre-training operation, because that's what I felt like I've always been good at. You know, that's kind of where I think my niche is. But I need to run some more horses. I think that's ultimately where I want to see myself in the next few years, is running more, because I haven't, you know, for being training 2 years, I've only had 40 starters, something along those lines. I'd like to do it more, because I think, you know, one of the things that's important for trainers is if you're training, whether you're doing breaking and pre-training and not running anything, you're going to experience some lows. You're going to have some times where some injuries and stuff goes wrong in the barn. And I think you have to experience the highs too, to make that worth it. And I think the only way to experience the highs is if you're running horses. You know, you got to have some of those successes. And as great as it is to go to the races and watch our other trainers do well with horses that I had a couple months ago, that's fun. But there's something about saddling winners, you know, that is, I'd like to do more of.
It becomes almost addictive, doesn't it?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of jockeys will talk about that. I've asked that question of guys like John Velasquez, for example, who comes back from an injury, or any of the jockeys who are coming back from long injuries. And you just look at them and say, why?
Yeah.
Why would you do this and put yourself out there again? Yeah. And
Rajiv.
Rajiv. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And they tell you, wow, this is who I am. This is what I do.
Yeah.
And that feeling of being aboard a horse, especially when you win, there's nothing like it.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't get that any other way. Yeah.
Same thing for a trainer.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important. If you're going to do this, you have to experience some of that, or you'll never last, you know.
Can you do both? Can you continue to break and train babies and saddle your own horse?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the rhythm that I have to find in the next year, is figure out a way to keep this operation running as it is, and also free myself up some to run some horses, which I've picked up a few here in the last few months, and the next 2 or 3 months looks like I'll have a lot of runners. But I've got a great assistant, Jerry Wiley, who's been helping me for a while now, and he's got 30 years of training experience under his belt, so he's been awesome. And I think that's ultimately what it boils down to, whether you're doing breaking and pre-training or just training, is you've got to have the right crew. I think probably everybody that's sat here has probably said something similar. You got to have, you know, the right people. That's what, you know, you either hear the old timers say that, you know, you got to keep the best company in the morning and the worst company in the afternoon. I think that's super important. And I think that, the sky's the limit when you've got the right crew. I don't think it'll be any problem continuing to do what I'm doing and getting some more now that I've got the right crew behind me, you know?
Yeah, it comes from the top down. I mean, when your crew knows that you're willing to do the work and they're gonna see 100%. You know, Bruce Headley, the great California trainer, he used to break babies at his house. Mm-hmm. He kept buying all the houses. He had a house zoned for horse property. He kept buying all the houses around him. Now he has his own little training center in the middle of Arcadia, 5 minutes from Santa Anita. It's insane. But, you know, he'd train his horses in the morning. He'd go home, break babies all mm-hmm. afternoon.
Yep.
You know, sometimes have them at Pomona too. So it's a matter of work ethic and all that. Yep. I mean, you can do a lot of things if you have the energy and the drive to do it. And it seems like you certainly do. At least at this point, you're not an old guy yet.
Not yet.
But Bruce was doing that well into his 60s.
I hope I can still do it.
Yeah.
Did you have trainers, Sam, that you looked up to as a kid, and you know, outside of your family, were there other trainers that you would watch and say, "Man, someday maybe that could be me"?
Yeah, I mean, I think if I had to name one, it would have to be D. Wayne, and I think it was less me looking up to him as a trainer and me. At the time, thinking, man, I want to go work for that guy. If there's anybody you would want to go work for, it's D-Wayne, because he can make you something. You know, he was maybe as good a trainer of trainers as he was a trainer of horses. But ultimately, I kind of decided that, you know, when I was in my young 20s, I kind of thought maybe the good thing for my career would be go gallop for one of the bigger operations. But I spent a long time thinking about it, and I kind of thought that I've learned so much from these little guys. And these guys that are struggling through claiming ranks, and these are the guys that can really teach me something. That they've managed to survive without the success that these other guys have had, and I think, you know, I could name some guys, but nobody in this room would have ever heard of them. But they did more for me than any of the big guys, because I didn't know them. You know, I think that's what it boiled down to. Is yeah, I saw some guys on TV and in the Daily Racing Form and stuff that I looked up to, but ultimately it was the guys that had 4 and 5 horses that I was galloping for that I had a ton of respect for and helped me out a lot. You know, because those are the guys that, you know, God, they've got to love it. 4 or 5 horses and struggling every day, and they're happy to be there.
Is there an optimal number of horses you'd like to have in your care?
I think the. I don't have any aspirations of being huge. I think any more than 40 gets difficult for anybody to really have a keen sense. And I think at that point you really have to start putting a lot of faith in your assistant. And while I do have a really incredible assistant, we kind of do everything together. And that's kind of how I like it, is both of us are in charge of these 40 horses, you know? So I think any more than that would probably get difficult for me to continue to do what I'm doing. Now, does that evolve down the road into maybe I'm doing something differently? Maybe. But for right now in the operation that I have, I think that, you know, any more than 40 would be difficult. And we're sitting at like 34 right now. So it's a good number. I'm happy with where we are right now. I'd like for a few more of those to be runners. But we'll get there.
Yeah, it takes a while sometimes, and you always have to pay your dues, as people say.
Absolutely.
But not everybody has to pay their dues. A lot of guys wake up in the morning, they got 5 stakes horses in their barn. I don't know how they do that. I never was that fortunate. But
I scroll past those stories.
Yeah. Yeah. Next. I don't want to hear about this. But it's tough. But the journey is cool, too. And
I wouldn't have had it any other way. I mean, I think... one of the things that was cool about hooking up with Gunpowder is I did get these you know, high profile good horses in the barn right off the bat, but they sent me this little thing from Woodbine to train for him, and it was kind of a project horse, and I told them after we won a couple races with her that I was like, you know, you guys had 70 horses in training or something, you could have sent me a push button horse, and I'm really glad that you didn't. I'm really glad that this is how I got, because now I feel like we earned it. You know, me and my team earned it. You could have sent me a good horse right off the bat that was just going to go out and win me some races. But I'm glad, because like you said, it's the journey. That's part of it. Absolutely. Is remembering how you got there.
It's kind of building respect from them too, because they probably said, well, we'll give him this one if he can do something with this one.
Exactly. Yeah.
Then we'll give him something better.
I like it. Exactly. Exactly. That they're testing the waters.
Yeah.
But we won an allowance race at Keeneland. So, I mean, that was huge for everybody. And that somehow that was Gunpowder's first Keeneland win as well.
That's cool.
Yeah, that was neat. Really for cool. as many races as they've won around the country, and they've got horses in Europe too, and to have never won one at Keeneland, it was awesome to get that done for him. And I had to give Buff some grief because he almost ruined it for me. Because the visitor got beat like a nostril like a week before an allowance race. He said, "Man, I'm sorry. I wish you would have won, but thanks, man.
I'm glad it was me." All right, Sam, only a couple minutes left, and we started this last week on the show. I'm going to do it with you as well. I thought it went pretty well last week.
Oh, I think I know what's coming.
Yeah, I usually to end by asking trainers to tell us something that people don't know about them. So here's what we're going to do. It's going to be five fast facts to know about Sam Logsdon. And here we go. I'll ask you five quick questions. You just give me your answer. Number one, your favorite flavor of ice cream?
Oh, chocolate.
All right. Favorite movie?
Big Lebowski.
Ooh, there you go. The racetrack you love the most, if you could pick one.
Keeneland.
Favorite wrestler?
Oh, Dan Gable.
Whoever the hell that is.
I could have named
him. He's no Sputnik Monroe, I'll tell you that.
Is there a wrestler that you know?
Sputnik Monroe.
The Iron Sheik. If you could do anything other than horse racing, what else might you see yourself doing?
Forest Service. When I was a little kid, I thought Forest Service would be cool. Working for the parks or something, you know, something along those lines. That's what I thought I was going to do for most of my childhood. Be a park ranger.
There you go. And that's Sam Logsdon. Five things to know about Sam. And you should know that he also has a website. If you want to visit his website, you can check out, SQLRacing.com. It'll tell you all you need to know about Sam and how you get in touch with him as well. And Sam, you're also on Twitter, right?
Yes. Twitter and Facebook. Right. SQL Racing.
There you go. SQL Racing. Make sure you follow him and check it out. Been a lot of fun, my friend. Thanks for coming.
Thanks, guys. It's been an honor.
Great to have you here.
Yeah. All right, for our producer, Lee Delapina, and for our special guest, Sam Logsdon, I want to remind you that you can head to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast of this show and all of our shows right there, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. We're back next week with an all-new Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. For Jude Feld, I'm Mike Pennell. We'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk.